tonight, a couple of announcements. Still could use another volunteer or two for watching Tabor on second session on Sunday, trying to set up a rotation where you wouldn't have to miss more than maybe one class a month. So if you're interested in applying that area, let Mary know. Also, again, 25th, 26th, 27th of September, there will be no class that week. So put that in your notes. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with this matter. Our two passages here, our two verses. 25, we're actually working on verse 26 now. Behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain. They figure for a powerful national, international, or global power that works at destroying the whole earth. And while I am not a big fan of the environmental, well, I would say I'm not a big fan of the rabid environmentalists who believe that everything is man's fault. The fact is, we have done things that are not conducive, particularly, and I don't know exactly what the mechanism was or has been. It appears to be related either to sugar or phosphate mining, but the algae and all that stuff in Okeechobee that's now getting out to the other coast and all of that, this is a result of man's actions, it certainly looks like. And so, and Pete was talking even on break about this matter of horizontal drilling, that's created problems. And again, we don't know what all they are doing. We're not supposed to. But when something goes wrong, we find out about it, like the Gulf spill out here. Everybody sure knew when technology failed then. Or the Exxon Valdez, or all of these other catastrophes that when they happen are devastating, not only to the local populations and all that, but the environment at large is not good for it. So they are, you destroy the whole earth. This is, again, maybe hyperbolic language a little bit, but the fact is, it is this charge that's laid against them. And I will stretch out my hand against you and roll you down from the crags, and I will make you a burnt out mountain. And in verse 26, they will not even take from you a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but you will be desolate forever, declares the Lord. And we left off here. We were down to point 42 here. However, as we talked about why this cannot be true of historical Babylon, you cannot fit this to history, this verse. It just won't work. But however, there are several historical works that clearly indicate that this was not the fate of historic Babylon, of ancient Babylon. There is evidence that Alexander the Great visited Babylon in 331 BC, about 200 years after its fall to the Medo-Persian Empire, and was given a hero's welcome. So the city was still a significant place 200 years later. That's pretty easily documented. Theodoret of Cyprus, point B here, indicates that Babylon was still inhabited by some Jews in 460 AD. And some 40 years later, the Babylonian Talmud was published. And then C, in 917 AD, Ibn Hankal reported there was a small village near that site. That village continued to exist, and of course by 1100 AD was known as Hillah. And so the fact is, Babylon continued to exist in some form. Now, it was declining. I'm not arguing that it wasn't declining. But it was still a viable city at some point. And again, for a couple hundred, 300 years later, after conquering by the Medo-Persians, our country isn't going to make 300 years. So Babylon, ancient Babylon survived longer. And of course, it had a history prior to that. Beginning back with the new Babylonian Empire and all of that under Nebuchadnezzar, obviously, in the 600s AD or BC, they were quite powerful. 43, Newton goes on to say that it is a known fact. That was Babylon, its future history and doom, that this wasn't, that's came out of his book by B.W. Newton. He goes on to say, it's a known fact that ancient Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar has been a reservoir of countless stones and bricks used in the building of numerous new towns up and down the Euphrates. That's in a work called Aids to Prophetic Inquiry. He cites several visitors to the area of Babylon who reported that the buildings in Helah, the city of some 50,000 located some 6 miles south of Babylon, had been built from reused material from ancient Babylon. And B, it is certain that Helah and various other cities in the neighborhood are built of materials taken from the ruins of Babylon, and that the ruins are continually resorted to, that should be for this purpose. Resorted to for this purpose. Now, I wouldn't have phrased it that way, but this is his quote, not mine. So, as is proved by the testimony of every traveler in the district. See, a recent documentary on the Smithsonian Channel made it quite clear that those living in the region have taken the ruins of Babylon and have used them in construction projects for centuries. That was called Secrets, Season 4, Episode 1, The Tower of... Now, they've gotten a lot of stuff wrong in there. If you go watch this show, don't say, oh, Ron, this ain't right. I know. But my point is here, they were documenting that they have repurposed this stuff over and over again from ancient Babylon. So you clearly cannot apply verse 26 at all to historic Babylon. It's just not true. There's too much evidence that it's not true. But yet, strangely enough, this has not forced hardly any interpreters to reconsider their position. Let's not let the text get in the way, by God. We've got our view, and we're going to force it on the text. It may end up being tortured and tormented to death, it may scream bloody murder, but we'll get it done. Well, yet that's not the way to approach this. When you find verses that don't fit with your grid, the first thing you better ask yourself, is my grid right? Because it's easy, and a doctrinal arrogance in doctrinal churches over the years, I've observed this. This doctrinal arrogance that we've got it right and nobody else can do it right, and we're just the cat's meow and the rest of them are all just idiots. Now, I'm not saying there aren't a bunch of crazy people out there. There are. But to get into an arrogant deal that we're the only persons doing it right, or that we are the only ones who have understanding, is nonsense. And that will destroy a ministry, that kind of arrogance, that I'm the only one that can be counted on. I even heard recently one pastor get up and say, I'm the expert here. Okay, well, right. And now you guys got to remember, I'm the expert, a self-appointed expert. No, not self-appointed. And I'm not even an expert. I wouldn't even get up and say that. I mean, that's the kind of arrogance that will get you into trouble, I think. But here, even after looking at the verses, they won't change their opinion, even though they know historically these verses don't fit ancient Babylon. And so then this brings the whole prophecy into disrepute because, and in some cases, just prophecy in general comes into disrepute because they don't have a proper theological grid. They don't have a place for this in their thinking. And obviously, but more and more, I have observed really over the last 5 years, and especially since we started this study, that more and more people are coming to the conclusion that, yeah, prophetic Babylon is the U.S. That they're figuring it out. They're figuring this out in these fundy churches. Now, the information's been around for a while. It actually goes back to a book that was written in 1969. It's where the original information came from. A pastor may have got up and said he did it, but he didn't. He got the information somewhere else. And this is why I am pretty big on this business of, and I know it takes extra paper and all that, but this business of footnote and documenting your sources and not just getting up and plagiarizing stuff. That's just inappropriate. So, it may be a pain, but at least you can also, an advantage to all of this too, is that you can, if you choose to, say we don't have class, something were to happen to me maybe, we couldn't have class for a month or something. Well, you've got plenty of things that you can research that are in the notes that you could, if you choose to. You say, well, we're not getting fed. Well, yeah, but if I can't do it, I couldn't do it. I mean, I wouldn't take off for a month just to take off. So then you can also look all this stuff up. So in the Smithsonian Channel, they were trying to say the Tower of Babel was built in the middle of Babylon, and that Nebuchadnezzar built the original Tower of Babel. Well, that's wrong. I know that's wrong. But the point is, they did touch on this very matter of repurposing this stuff, and that they have used this stuff repeatedly. And these are known facts. This isn't just some doctrinal speculation. These are documentable facts. So they went on to say that the concept of rebuilding and recycling was a Babylonian tradition that continued for hundreds of years. And in 44, back in 71, UNESCO declared its willingness to assist Iraq in fully rebuilding the ancient city of Babylon. Saddam Hussein, former president, was required to supervise the reconstruction. In 78, there was a vast highway built within Babylon. Along it were numerous brick factories engaged in forming bricks for this enormous reconstruction project. However, it is evident that this enterprise never succeeded. And current events also tend to indicate that it never will. Babylon, and again, there are still people, believe it or not, who hold to the view that Babylon's going to be rebuilt and it's going to become the world power again. And that is just so misguided. Historically, I don't know how you could look really at the course of this world, the way it's gone, the place it's currently at, and say that you really feel like Iraq is going to become a major world power and dominate the international scene to the point where it's called a mountain, a giant mountain that towers over these others. So, that's not going to happen. But there are still people who hold to that viewpoint, that this is ancient Babylon rebuilt. But how much time would you even need for that to happen? And I would suggest to you, given where we are in the 7,000 years of human history, as we close in on the 6,000th year of it, that life on earth, as man knows, it's going to change, and change horribly. People are unprepared for what's going to happen. And again, we didn't have a great deal of devastation at all from the hurricane, but I've seen other places that did. And when you go through one of those things, you really feel for them a little more. That it isn't fun. People may like living on Hawaii, not that great necessarily. Volcano blowing up, destroying the land. Now you got hurricanes out there. Well, I guess they get to be typhoons after a point. I don't know when they change, but I think it's where you cross the line there somewhere. Becomes a typhoon. But the fact is, you know, the other day they got 48 inches of rain in like 2 days. Can you imagine what would happen here if that happened? 48 inches of rain in 2 days. I was here in 93, I think it was. 93 or 94, somewhere in there. There was a tropical storm. It never formed into anything big, but it just rained horrifically. We got something like 16 or 17 inches in 3 days. And you couldn't get around. I couldn't drive from my house to anywhere without having to detour around water. And that was a small one in the big scheme of things. And I had friends here in town at that time. The Browns were here, in fact. And they were staying out on Siesta Key. I went out there. Their parking lot was waist deep. And they lived, of course, they were staying in a tower, which was good because they were up on the seventh floor in an 8-story building or something. So they were in good shape. But to get from the parking lot down to the place, you waded through waist-deep water. And I am not exaggerating. And so, again, these kinds of catastrophes, the idea that ancient Babylon is going to be rebuilt or become this world power, that's just unbelievable to me that people could buy that. But anyway, so at 45, given all this historical information, it is not possible to conclude that ancient Babylon or modern Babylon has ever resided in a state of total desolation, which the imperfect of the verb hayah, to become, indicates that it will. That verb, of course, denotes a change of status. You will become, they tend to translate this as like it's a to be verb, but it's not. But you will become desolate forever, of course, which means that they weren't desolate then, before this, prior to this. again, declares the Lord. So Babylon's final status is expressed by the feminine noun shamama, desolation, which is derived from the verb shamem, which means to make desolate. The verb first, again, refers to the devastation and desolation that results from some great disaster. That destruction is often understood to be a result of divine judgment. And obviously, in our case, what we're studying here, it is as well. Leviticus 26, and I think this is in the passage on the five cycles of discipline. Verse 22, I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which will bereave you of your children, and destroy your cattle, and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted. And I think that's our that's our verb there. To lie deserted is the way they've translated it there. To lie deserted. So 48:1 lexicon indicates that the verb means to suffer destruction, with the implication of being deserted and abandoned. That's the resulting state. And that often as a consequence of divine judgment and or defeat at the hands of some enemy. And the cognate, see, there's two nouns that come off of this verb. Shamama, which refers to the actual desolation. And there's another noun that comes off of this that refers to the way people feel when they see it. And that's called an object of horror, is the way they'll translate that. But the object of horror, you know, the desolation is what produces that horror in people when they see it. And again, I can't remember what it was. I think it was, yeah, I don't know what it was. One of the, wasn't Hunger Games, one of those movies, the Maze Runner movies. And they had these pictures, and I just thought to myself, God, what a perfect shot of what America's going to look like after all of this. And it was just waste and devastation as far as you could see. And no humans and all of that. And of course, I understand, you know, sci-fi movies and all that stuff, they have this. All right, well now verse 27, let's move on here. Lift up a signal in the land. Blow a trumpet among the nations. Consecrate nations against her. Here we have some cal imperative here, masculine plurals of Nasa. N-A-S-A apostrophe. That means to raise up or lift up. A signal is NAS. We've seen this before, N-E-S. This is a signal or a standard, a flag, an ensign. In the land, preposition bait here with the noun eretz, the land. Blow a trumpet among the nations. The verb here is ta-ka, T-A-Q-A apostrophe. This means to strike or to clap the hands. And it also is used a blowing on a wind instrument. So context would have to kind of tell you in that case how you would translate that. But here, you follow this by the term shofar. S-H-O-F-A-R. That's the ram's horn, the trumpet. The shofar, this is the horn that was blown on several of Israel's feast days to announce certain things. Here, not used in that context. Here, used in a military context of assembling. And as we've seen here, again, now we've moved temporally back to prior to the time of the destruction. He just told Babylon in two verses, here's what I'm going to do to you. And now he backs up, as it were, temporally to before all of that. And says, here is the command to assemble the fighting force. The force that's going to destroy you. So blow a trumpet among the nations. Inseparable preposition bait here with the definite article ha, and then the plural of goy. G-O-Y, among the nations. Consecrate the nations against her. This is the language of holiness. Kadash here actually is the verb. Q-A-D-H-A-S-H. Kadash means to set apart, to consecrate. That should be consecrate. I misspelled there. To dedicate. It's the language used of temples, of holiness, of one who is appropriate to approach God. or in the ancient cults, gods, as they believe. But so this is what is set apart to God's service. So in this sense, the nations become God's servants as they engage in this command to destroy Babylon. Now, they're not God's servants in the sense that they're all believers and that they've got their act together or anything like that. But they're set apart by God for this particular purpose, and they will do it. They will fulfill that purpose. So consecrate the nations against her. Consecrate there is to set apart the nations against her. Again, preposition al. We've seen this repeatedly with the third person feminine singular suffix. Against her, the nations. Goy in the plural again, goyim. Summon against her the kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz. Summon is actually a dehiphial imperative of Shamah, S-H-A-M-A apostrophe. This means literally to cause to hear. The verb means to hear. So cause somebody to hear, to proclaim it to them. Here they've translated it as summons. It's the idea of causing them to hear means to call to them. That's how you make people hear, is you raise up your voice. Summon against her the kingdoms. Kingdoms here is Mamlaka. Comes from the root Malak or Malak. The verb means to rule over. Here, M-A-M-L-A-K-H. A-H. A mamlaka, that means dominions or kingdoms, that which is ruled over by a king. Proper noun here, now you've got this word, Ararat, apostrophe A-R-A-R-A-T. It transliterates over pretty neatly into the English. Four times, now this is a region in Armenia, modern Armenia. Proper noun that follows here is mini. M-I-N-N-I-Y. One time this is only used. These are obviously, these three kingdoms are only mentioned a total of eight times between them. Four for one for one, and three for the other. So we'll look at this on a map and kind of show you the areas in view. A wow here plus the proper noun Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz, actually. Apostrophe A-S-H-K-E-N-A-Z. Again, pretty well transliterates over into the English. Three times, Ashkenaz is a son of Japheth. The Japhethites of the sons of Noah, the Semites tended to occupy the Middle East and that region, Israel and all of that. Descendants of Ham tended to go south. Mitzrayim was one of the first great kingdoms. That's Egypt. Mitzrayim was founded by a son of Ham. Or by Ham himself, I can't remember. Japheth, the idea behind the name Japheth, even, it means to be expansive, to be spread out. And they tended to go everywhere. They went north in out of... Of course, all of these were at the flood. Were right there pretty much in the Middle East. We know that the ark landed on the mountains of Ararat, not Mount Ararat, the mountains of Ararat. And that's a region. So we don't know specifically where it is. It might still be there. The remains of it might have survived some. Who knows? People say they've seen it in modern times. But they don't want people, and it's a pretty dangerous region anyway at this point. So no reason to want to go over there. I don't need to see the ark, by the way, to believe it was there. The Bible says it was, and that's fine with me. I'll take the Bible's word for it. So I don't have to see it. I believe it by faith. So you got these three regions, and we'll deal with that. But the Japhethites, they went north, and there was a lot of room up there. They moved up out into Armenia, southern Russia, up into Russia, moved over towards Europe and all of that. And so they occupied the most space of the descendants of Noah. That came out of the ark. Appoint a marshal against her. Bring up the horses like bristly locusts. Appoint a marshal here. Again, Japheth, this is the area in the Ukraine, Georgia, southern Russia, and Kazakhstan. appoint a marshal. Cal imperative of pakad. We've seen this verb a number of times because it's used in a number of ways. But here, to oversee, to appoint, to visit, first it means, against her, again, a preposition al with the third feminine singular suffix, a marshal. This is a mifsar, M-I-P-H-S-A-R. Mifsar, two times. This is an Assyrian term that means scribe or marshal. The term seems to have designated military officials who recorded the names of recruits. And it had to do with the military activities of Assyrian kings. More on that when we get into the exposition. Appoint a marshal against her. Bring up the horses like bristly locusts. Again, bring up is cause to come up, hifil, of the causative stem of Allah. And this word means to ascend or to go up. Hence, cause to bring up. Horse, masculine singular noun. They've translated as a plural here. It is a collective singular. You couldn't bring just one horse, of course. Is right. A horse, of course. You wouldn't bring just one. So again, they understood this correctly as a collective singular and translated it like a plural. Locust, and then rough or bristly. The word yelek, Y-E-L-E-Q, I believe is the most common term for locust in the Old Testament. And then you have this word that's only used once, samar. Here, the adjective, S-A-M-A-R. The adjective seems to mean rough or bristly. The problem is here, we don't have anything to compare it with. So it's tough to know what's in view. And again, we recognize that Jeremiah has to describe all this in the terms with which he's familiar. He couldn't say, load up the nuclear warheads and get the launch codes and get ready to fire. He couldn't say, organize these nations and their nuclear arsenals. Because he wouldn't know what a nuclear arsenal was. Consecrate the nations against her. The kings of the Medes, their governors and all their prefects, and every land of their dominion. Consecrate is again the word of holiness, kadash. To set apart, to consecrate for a purpose against her, preposition al with the third feminine singular. The nations, masculine plural noun of goy. Then you follow here with the sign of the direct object, which means specifically who he wants. Nations is the more general term. But as we've seen, the prophetic Medes are seen to head this up. The kings of the Medes. You got the sign of the direct object, eth, E-T-H. And then that noun, melech, kings of the Medes. Here this would be a genitive of subordination. The kings that rule over the Medes. They are there. The kings of the Medes, their governors, sign of the direct object again. Plus the masculine plural noun construct here of this term, pekah. P-E-C-H-A-H. Again, an Akkadian loan word means a governor or the lord of a district. A lesser ruler than, say, a king. Not the primary ruler in that sense. Their governors and all their prefects. Again, another sign of the direct object with the masculine singular noun of kol. All of, in the construct state. All of, and then we saw this term before, segen. S-E-G-H-E-N. Segens, used 17 times. It means a prefect or a lower ruler. And so, again, they use English terms because we don't know specifically what all was involved in some of these terms because it's lost to us. Nor does it matter because we understand in political realms and all of that, in the establishment chain of command, that there's layers of authority throughout there. Even Solomon acknowledged that in Ecclesiastes. When you see injustice in the province, don't be shocked. Because this guy has a boss he answers to. And this guy has a boss he answers to. And guess what? They all know about it. Nobody's doing anything. But they know about it. So he recognized these layers of authority. And that's all that's involved in here with this. The governors and all of their prefects. And every land of their dominion. Again, another sign of the direct object here with coal. Again, all of the lands, Eretz, of their dominions, Memlekah here. Again, 17 times a rule or a dominion or a realm over which somebody rules. So, let's see, 26, 27 there. And there you go. All right, well, point one, these two verses return to the time previous to the attack on Babylon and contain a series of seven imperatives directed towards Babylon's enemies. Again, I think most of the time, that's why in this one that we just finished, that section that I believe must refer to the tribe of Jacob, that it seems very clear when he's addressing the enemies. These are not vague. And of course, very often it uses imperatives. It's not an explanation, it's a series of commands. So, the first imperative involves the raising a signal flag. The Hebrew term nace generally refers to a rallying point or standard, which drew people together for some common action or for the communication of important information. Three, this standard was normally raised on a high or conspicuous place within the camp or the community as a point of focus. And in fact, if you look back in Isaiah 13, I believe that was the very same thing. Yeah, but here it has the added deal in verse 2. Lift up a standard, that's nace, on the top of a mountain made bare or a hill made bare, but it's to be very, very visible. That's the whole idea. That is to be put where everybody can see it. And that's how you mobilize people in the ancient world. Now, we don't do that now. Obviously, communication's different. But Jeremiah couldn't say, get on the phone, use your cell phone and call Kazakhstan and get Borat and tell him that it's time to invade America. You don't do that. Jeremiah wouldn't be able to handle that. Well, three, again, it's raised in a conspicuous spot. Four, the next imperative deals with an audible sound involving a horn or trumpet, which was also used as a signal to assemble in preparation for battle, and that's not unusual. I don't know that they're still doing it, but certainly you had certain bugle commands, if you know anything about more modern warfare, that you had certain bugle commands that would signal to the troops what you wanted done. Whether it was attack, whether it was retreat, taps, we know what that's for. Time for bed. So you in a reveille, we know what that trumpet's for. Time to get up. Or time to assemble, anyway. So this deals with that, which was used to signal Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 5. And it's a similar language as you might expect. Declare in Judah and proclaim in Jerusalem. And say, blow the trumpet in the land. Cry aloud and say, assemble yourselves. Let us go into the fortified cities. Lift up a standard toward Zion. Seek refuge. Do not stand still. Now, ironically enough, in this passage in Jeremiah, this is referring to the coming Babylonian invasion for Israel. And then, of course, this is where Jeremiah, by the end of the book, of course, he's dealing with prophetic Babylon, I understand. But for the reader of that time, Babylon is seen as this great northern enemy that God's warned him about that's coming and is going to take him out. And then by the end of the book, he's reinforced the idea that eventually the Jews are going to survive all this. That they're not going to be destroyed by Babylon. In fact, Babylon will be destroyed for them. And God obviously is going to oversee all this, as we know. Well, five, the Hebrew verb takah. Blow is used to describe forceful movements, like the pounding of an object or thrusting an object into something else. Isaiah 22, verse 23. And obviously the blowing of a horn or a bugle is a forceful, a kind of noise. Here I will drive him like a peg in a firm place. And that's this for drive is how it's translated here. Like you would, smash, hit it with a hammer. That's the first way it's used. And then also, or thrusting, again, a forceful movement, Judges 3:21. I think this is where this king gets killed. So one of the guys, and I can't remember who this is that comes in here, but somebody from Israel comes in and he says, keep silence in verse 19. And Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud's the guy that comes to him, the king's up there. And he said, I have a message from God for you. And when somebody comes up to you and says this, you better be worried. And he arose from his seat, and Ehud stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into the belly. That's the word, our verb there is translated thrust, what you would expect of a sword. And this was a fat king because the handle went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade. For he did not draw out the sword out of his belly, and the refuse came out. Welcome to lunch. Here the verb has the idea of, you know, the thrusting, the strong motion you would make to run a sword through somebody, to drive it through. So in most poetic literature, this term refers to the clapping of hands. However, the majority of uses refer to the matter of blowing a trumpet. In Psalms, of course, as you should know, that they are poems. 47:1 here. For the choir director, a psalm of the sons of Korah. O clap your hands, all peoples. Shout to God with a voice of joy. And there, our verb is translated as clap your hands. Clap your palm. You know, the idea of your palms, actually. It's cough, it's your palm. So 7, the third command here. Now back to our verse here in verse 27. Lift up a signal, blow a trumpet, consecrate is now our third command. The third command involves the nations dedicating themselves to the battle, which some have understood in terms of religious rituals performed prior to battle. Now it is a fact that historically armies and nations did this. They would bring the gods out or go to the temple and whatever, and they would bless the army, anoint them and do various other things, provide them with whatever amulets or charms or spells that they thought they needed to protect their army. And so this was not, in fact, uncommon for these religious rituals to accompany going into combat. So those entering the battle would seek protection and victory from their particular deity. We see this, say, in 1 Samuel. They would all pray to their God. It's like people praying about football games. Well, half of them are praying for this team, and the other half are praying for the other team. I don't know that God cares, frankly. I think maybe God's got bigger fish to fry. And obviously, in God's eternal plan, we know it's going to unfold a certain way. Now, we don't know how it's going to unfold, but we pretty much want our team to win. But doesn't the other people want their team to win? So God's bombarded with prayers from both sides, and He said, "If I could just get them into Bible class, but I can get 80,000 of these idiots in a stadium on a Saturday." Can you imagine if we had to get 80,000 people out here? Well, we'd need more space, you know. God can't get the time of day out of these people. And again, if you know anything about football and going to these games, I've never actually gone to one, and I don't care to. But I know it starts early in the day with the tailgating out in the parking lot. It's important to get together and drink heavily and eat a lot before you go to these games. And, of course, fights never break out at football games or in places like that. It's all just very mild-mannered and fun. It's a great environment for your kids. Nobody gets drunk and rowdy and all that. And of course they do. I'm being facetious. Because this is why Major League Baseball stopped serving beer after a certain point. I think it's after the 7th inning. You can't get a beer anymore. Why? Because fights kept breaking out in the 8th and 9th innings. Because the people were drunk. And we can get people to do all this. You can even get 20,000 up there to go watch the Rays who won't even field a quality team. 20,000 people to watch a... And then the Rays are pretty good, but the problem is they're never going to field a quality team because they're always selling off their good players. So, but you can get plenty of people to go do that, you know, and all the parking. I've gone to a baseball game, $20 for parking, $30 or $40 or $50 for the tickets. Depends on where you want to sit. And then, you know, you got your $10 hot dogs, your $9 beer, and before you know it, my God, you've spent $250 all in a baseball game that you could have watched on Channel 577 at home. And I like watching them at home, frankly, because I like instant replay. I like being able to look at stuff. You know, I like a live game, too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's a fun afternoon to kill some time for entertainment purposes. Probably cheaper than going to the casino, you know, and gambling away your life savings. So where are we here? 1 Samuel 13, 8 through 12. So again, people seek God's protection, and that's understandable. So he waited 7 days now, according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. This is Saul. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering, and as soon as he offered the burnt offering, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" And he said, "Well, because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore, I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal. And I have not asked the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself to play a priest." Well, this is a problem. You're not a priest. You're not a priest. He was not in the priesthood. This was illegal for him to do. And also wrong. The Mosaic law made it clear this was to only be done by authorized representatives, the sons of Aaron. And so I forced myself. See, I was just really looking out for... It's your fault, really, Samuel. You didn't show up, and that's the real problem here. Now, why are you interviewing me? But Saul, at this point, Saul had already started to lose it. Saul had already maladjusted to the fact that David was going to replace him. And all of that, he was going to retain his position at all costs, so he thought. And guess what? God will get him. And God finally takes him out. And Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart." Somebody who really has God's interest as their focal point. That really are more interested in God and his plan than their own way of doing things. Saul became very self-willed. And this is what did him in. Now Saul is an example of a believer who goes into reversionism and dies to sin unto death. And that's not a way to go out. That's how many, many believers are going to go, but that's not the way to go. And he certainly did, as we have seen. Well, 8 here, while there may be some religious rituals involved, this command once again indicates that the attacking army is set apart for God's purpose. And God's purpose is the destruction of Babylon. And he's got this army poised and ready to do his will. And so it's just a matter of assembling them at the right time. All of this gets into timing, of course, of what is God's timing in all of this. Because that's what matters. When he decides to give the signal, when he decides to motivate these people, and again, there's a lot of ways he can work in this. He can just actively motivate them himself. But then there's current events, there's things we're doing, there's things going on in Russia, obviously there. They have their whole deal they have to deal with. But all these things are going to come together in the perfect storm. And they're going to realize this country is ripe for the picking. And they're going to realize they can take us. And the reality is, if anybody's done the research, 33 minutes, that's all you got. 33 minutes. Because these things are going to be, again, they've got these missiles now that are capable of hitting 17,000, 18,000 miles an hour. So how long does it take to travel 6,000 miles?
Oh, not long.
Not long if you're going 18,000 miles an hour, about a third of an hour, about 20 minutes. So obviously they're slow at first when they take off, obviously, as they're trying to get above the atmosphere. So they'll be able to get these things around here. And again, what if there's a religious ritual, I don't know that that's in view here. But it's certainly saying that these are the people that God has picked for this particular task. They are his weapons. And they're set apart for him for that purpose. So 9, what follows deals with summoning three specific peoples, each of which are referred to as kingdoms. The first is the kingdom of Ararat, which is a term that is only used 4 times in the Old Testament. Interpreters are generally in agreement that this kingdom occupied what is now modern Armenia. And let me look here. There you go. Okay. So this little area in here, eastern, and of course these boundaries, when I was in school, these weren't even countries. So these boundaries change, obviously, and fluctuate at some level. But this kind of area in here, as we're going to see, this area and this area over this way, up around the Caspian Sea, these are the regions that are being discussed in this area. Eastern Turkey, sort of all the way over to Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. Of course, that's some of this is... there, I just didn't mean to move that, but but this is kind of the region we're talking about in here, and this is why, of course, even from Babylon here, down here, Babylon, it was due north, even up there. This is why there were constant references to the north. Although, again, most commands and most directions in the Bible appear to be given from the standpoint of Israel or Jerusalem. That it's west is to the sea here, east is this way to the sunrise, south and then north. And this north, that word Zaphon in the Hebrew, has the idea of what is hidden, what is kind of unknowable. And certainly as you got up, as mankind eventually began to populate these areas, all of this was unknown in the beginning, at any rate. There's Ararat here. Modern Armenia. The second term for the second kingdom is Mini. It's found only here, but most interpreters believe it was located in what is now eastern Turkey and northern Iran, kind of more in this particular area here. That's kind of the best guess. Whoops, don't want that. All right. Must be getting time to quit almost. The third kingdom of Ashkenaz refers to nomadic tribes that were located further to the north. Mackay and others believe that they were probably to be identified with the Scythians. This is a Greek name that was found in Herodotus. That's out of the Mentor Commentary series, second volume of Jeremiah. 13, this group appeared to occupy the largest area, as nomads would. And that would be not unexpected. I mean, nomadic people travel around and they need more space. They don't want to be confined to a particular region, necessarily. Which would include the region of modern Georgia, Azerbaijan, and southern Russia. These nomads were known as fierce warriors and good horse breeders, which probably accounts for the references to horses. That's out of the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds there, Volume 4. But Jeremiah 50:42. They seize their bow and javelin, they're cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roars like the sea and they ride on horses. Marshaled like a man for the battle against you, O daughter of Babylon. And then 51:27, I think that's our verse that we're working on right now. Summon these kingdoms against her. 14, however, there is an isagogic problem in accepting this as having an historical fulfillment, since Cyrus and the Scythians were not allies at this time. Cyrus was later killed, circa 530 BC, by a queen regarded by many to be Scythian. You can look that up on academia.edu. You may not be able to get that article. That's one of the places I signed up for. You may have to sign up to get it, and you probably don't want to, but I can probably download it if you're wanting to read it. This was an article about the Medes, Scythians, and Persians and the rise of Darius. I think you have to either have to upload documents. You can download documents to look at stuff, but you have to have a membership. It doesn't cost anything, but you have to have either something to offer or they want to charge you. It will cost something if you don't have anything to offer. So I got lots of documents to offer. I noticed not too many of them are getting read. Because they keep track on there, they'll tell you how many, you know. So I've uploaded every time I need a new document or want to read something, I'm doing research, I'll upload a new USA and Prophecy chapter that I haven't sent them yet. And but they're not getting read much. I think in about 6 months, 8 months, I think they've had 4 views or something. So it's not real, real popular stuff. Okay, well, our time is gone. We'll go ahead and stop there with the... and we'll deal more with the Scythians and all of this at Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship with like-minded believers. We thank you for the grace you continue to provide, even in these horrific times. And pray that we will continue to grow to maturity and beyond, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.